This is Audible.
Recorded Books and One Click Digital present Any Other Name by Craig Johnson, narrated by George Guidel and directed by Abigail McHugh. The author begins this novel with the following quote from Act 2, Scene 2 of Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. And now, any other name.
Chapter 1. Joseph Conrad said that if you wanted to know the age of the earth, look upon the sea in a storm. If you want to know the age of the Powder River country, just be on the wrong side of a coal train. A guy who worked for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe once told me that the trains in northern Wyoming are about 140 cars and a mile and a half long. But it sure seems longer than that when you're waiting on one. Lucian Connolly, my old boss, and the retired sheriff of Absaroka County, reached into his pocket and pulled out his beaded tobacco pouch the Cheyenne elders had given him, along with the name Nido Nestigo, he who sheds his leg. Damn, this is a long one. He also pulled his briarwood pipe from the inside pocket of his light jacket, much too light for the weather, and fingered a small packet of wooden matches along with it. We used to get calls from the railroad detectives. What a useless bunch, wanting us to come down and identify the hobos that climbed in the hoppers back in Chicago and Milwaukee, and with the slick sides and the rail car walls, they couldn't get out. He stuffed a small amount of the tobacco into the bowl of his pipe. They'd pull those cars into the mines and dump tons of coal on them. Imagine their surprise. Homeless. He turned to look at me. What? Homeless. They don't call them hobos anymore. He nodded his head and looked back at the train. Flat as a damn pancake is what I called them. I watched the cars roll and felt the ground shake. The single largest source of coal in the United States, the Powder River Basin, contains one of the largest deposits in the world and has made Wyoming the top coal-producing state since the late 80s. He pulled a match from the pack and made ready to strike. Pulverized pepper steak. Wasn't a lot to identify, I can tell you that much. The major cities of the Wyoming portion of the basin are Gillette and Sheridan. In Montana, Miles City. The rest of the 24,000 square miles is what they call sparsely populated, and I call Durant and home. It was a Saturday. Flat as a flitter. I was tired. Identify my ass. And I was about to lose my patience. Looked like hamburger. I scrubbed a hand across my face. Old man, you're not going to light that pipe in my truck. He looked over at me for a moment, the silence between us carrying the electric charge of decades, grunted, then pulled the door handle and climbed out of the bullet. The clanging of the warning bells amplified through the open door before he slammed it behind him and hobbled on his one real and one fake leg to the corner of my grill guard, at which point he recommenced lighting his pipe with a great deal of dramatic flourish. It was December on the high plains, but you never know it to look at him, cupping his knotted hands together without a shiver or gloves for that matter, and ducking his Stetson open road model hat down against the wind. Amplified by the flashing red lights of the railroad crossing barrier, the brief flicker of orange glowed, reinforcing the impression that he was the devil and that the deal I had struck with him was venal and binding. He raised his head, the consistent wind that battled the onward rushing of the train pulling at the brim of his hat like a miniature tornado, his eyes almost squeezed shut with nothing showing but the stained, walnut-colored irises glinting black in the half-light. I looked down at the letter lying on the center console. The postmark was from a week ago, and the return address was Gillette in the Iron Horse subdivision, which was located on the other side of the rumbling coal cars. Gillette was in Campbell County, technically out of my jurisdiction as the Absaroka County Sheriff. My daughter was having a baby in a matter of days, and I was supposed to be visiting her in Philadelphia. Instead, I was here, helping Lucian resolve his debt to a dead man. A barely audible whine keened from the back seat, and I reached around and ruffled the fur behind Dog's ears. The combination St. Bernard slash German Shepherd slash Dire Wolf glanced at Lucian. The brim of my mentor's hat was pressed against the crown of his forehead, making it seem as if he was galloping at high speed like some soul-damned ghost rider in the sky. I thought about how easy it would be to just throw the big three-quarter ton into reverse and back out, turn around and take Route 1416 back up to the Gillette Airport to jump on a plane. But they likely wouldn't allow dogs, so that was out. Wondering what it was I was doing here, other than playing the role of chauffeur, I leaned back into my leather seat and felt the pressure of my Colt 1911. "Maybe they'll have this talk, and then we'll turn around and go home." I looked at Dog again, but he didn't seem convinced. Turning back and watching the old sheriff stare at the train, I sighed. "Yep, me neither." Pulling the collar of my sheepskin coat a little tighter and cranking my hat down so that it didn't follow the train to Oregon, I pulled the handle on my door and slid my boots to the gravel surface. I crunched around to the front of the bullet to lean on the grill guard with him. I spoke loudly in the field voice my father had never let me use in the house, just to be heard above the endless procession of open cars and the bells that hammered their warning. They still do. He studied me with a clenched eyeball and said nothing, puffing on his pipe like he was pulling the mile of coal himself. Fine bodies in the hopper cars. The ass end of the train went by, another disappointment in that it was not a caboose, but rather another set of locomotives helping to push from the rear, and I got that familiar feeling I always did whenever a train passed, that I should be on it. But it was going the wrong way. Suddenly the bony arms of the crossing gates rose, and the incessant clanging stopped. We listened to the wind for a while, and then the old man beat his pipe empty on the hard surface of the grill guard, unintentionally repeating the coda of the klaxons. "Hard times." With this singular pronouncement, he turned and climbed back in, leaving me watching the skies peeled back in folds of gray, darker and darker to the horizon. He honked the horn behind me. Flakes were streaking in the wind like bad reception as we pulled up to the house, an unassuming one, one that you'd drive right by thinking that there must be happy people inside. At least that's the way I like to think. We both sat there, dreading what was coming. He cleared his throat and started to say something. "What?" Gazing out the side window at a deflated Santa Claus that looked as if it might have over-imbibed in holiday festivities, he grumbled, "Boom or bust." "What?" "Oil, natural gas, and coal. You used to have bumper stickers over here that read Campbell County. Give us one more boom and we won't screw it up." He continued to study the Santa, looking even more like it might have arrived in the bottom of a train car. "Used to see a woman here back in the day. Used to drive over here on Sundays. She lived alone in this big old house and had money. Used to like spending it on me. Never saw her out on the town, never mentioned other men, never bothered me, calling or anything like that, and was always glad to see me. Whenever we got together, we'd end up in motels over in Rapid or up in Billings. We'd mix drinks in this big champagne gold 62 Cadillac she had. Whatever happened to her?" He stayed like that for a moment, not moving, and then nodded once. "Hell if I know." Lucian got out of the truck, and I trudged along after him through the snow that had just started blowing to South Dakota, made a detour into the yard, and reattached the small air compressor to the hose that led to Santa's boot heel. The jolly old elf rippled on the ground as if trying to crawl away, but then slowly grew and stood with an arm raised, a fine patina of coal dust covering his jaunty red suit. I walked onto the porch where Lucian had rung the bell. "That your civic duty for the day?" "Evidently not. Here I am with you, and I should be in Philadelphia with Katie." Nothing happened, so he turned the knob and walked in. "What are you doing?" He looked at me, still standing on the front porch in the wind and scattered snow. He didn't say anything, but limped off into the house. I had the choice of following him or standing out there freezing my butt off. I entered, careful to wipe my feet before stepping onto the unusually wide plastic runners that lay on the white carpeting, and, leaning to the side, saw Lucian round a corner past a room divider to go into the kitchen. I unbuttoned my coat and stuffed my gloves in my pockets and followed, hoping that if somebody got shot, it would be him and not me. He was gristly and could take it. When I got to the kitchen, no one was there, only an electric wheelchair parked beside a door open at the far end of the room that led to a basement with one of those fancy stairway elevators that you see in the octogenarian catalogs I've been receiving far too often lately. I reached over and touched the joystick on the spacey-looking wheelchair, and it jumped forward, crashing into my leg. Ouch! I gently pushed the stick back so that the contraption parked itself in the exact same spot. Glancing around the kitchen, I was struck by how clean and orderly and white it was, like a museum or somebody's heaven. There was a humming sound from the basement and what sounded like typing, and peering down the steps, I could see that lights were on down there, flickering blue ones as if from a couple of televisions. Easing myself around the track for the chair elevator, I started down the steps. Lucian was sitting on an overstuffed leather sofa and was leafing through a magazine. At the bottom of the stairs, I got a better view of the dimly lit room, which was dominated by three huge flat-screen televisions surrounding a counter with two computer monitors. An older, platinum-haired woman, seated in another wheelchair, raised her hand and waved at me. I took off my hat and waved back. She smiled and shrugged, her head encased in a massive set of headphones, her eyes redirected to one of the screens, and what I could now see was an end-of-the-season football game, Oakland and San Diego. Stepping around the counter in front of Lucian, I watched as she casually tapped the elongated keys of the stenotype-like machines at her fingertips, belying the speed at which the words were magically appearing up on the closed-captioned portions of the screen. After a while, with no other recourse, I sat on the sofa with Lucian and waited. There was another door which must have led to another room, but little else. She does closed captioning for the NFL? He flipped another page in the Field and Stream magazine and glanced up at Phyllis Holman, still tapping away like Morse code. Football, baseball, hockey, you name it, she does it. His head dropped back to the tips on wild turkey hunting. Knows more about sports than any man I know. Hi. She had pulled one of the ear cups back and was looking at me. Commercial break. Nice to meet you, Mrs. Holman. I glanced around at all the technology. Quite a setup you've got here. She shrugged.
It keeps me occupied.
I looked at one of the TVs, my mind playing pinball in an attempt to find something to say as the talking heads came back on the screen. Who's your favorite announcer? She quickly pulled the headphone back over her ear, her attention returning to the keyboards.
Anyone who talks slowly and distinctly.
I watched her work for a while, and then, with my interest not being piqued by either of the teams or by any of the Field and Stream turkey tips, I sidled into the corner of the sofa and pulled my hat over my face. It was not a new dream. The one that overtook me, rather a continuation of an experience that I had back in the spring. There was snow. There was always snow in my dreams, or visions, as my good buddy Henry Standing Bear called them. In this one I was post-holing my way in thigh-deep snow, old and laden, both me and the snow. The collar was up on my coat and my hat was hard on my head, defending against the wind. The visibility was horrible, and I could see only about 10 feet in front of me. I was following something, something that didn't want to be followed. There were other shapes, darker ones, that hurtled around me, but the creature continued on. The tracks were difficult to see in the whiteout, but the others continued to dodge their way around me, and I could hear their breathing, heavy and dangerous. I reached down to clutch the side of my hip where my sidearm should have been resting under my coat, but there was nothing there, and that was when I saw that the thing had turned, and what I was following had horns.
You know Gerald, Lucian. He never would have done something like this. It just wasn't like him.
I didn't move. Just stayed as I was. A stakeout under a hat. Lucian's voice sounded tired, and I started to weaken, thinking of all the conversations like this that he'd had to endure. He was a good man, fellas, but I'm not so sure there's anything anybody can do about this. I spoke with Sandy Sandberg, and he said,
"Don't mention that man's name in this house."
There was a silence. Nonetheless, he said that—
They wrapped it up too quickly, Lucian.
He made a guttural noise in his throat. God damn it, fellas. It was the investigators down in Cheyenne that did the autopsy at DCI. You know as well as I do that when a man like Gerald Holman dies, they have to do a complete—
They didn't like him. They didn't like him, and they're trying to cover something up. I can tell by the way they look at me. I was a court reporter, remember, and I developed an ability to read people. I can tell when people are lying. Believe me, I've heard enough of it.
Another long pause.
You know as well as I do that these things happen for two reasons. Either it's trouble at home or trouble on the job. Now, I know there wasn't any trouble at home, so—
How's your daughter? How's Izzy? There was a pause, and then she answered.
Connie's fine.
I could feel the two of them staring at each other.
We haven't had to use the room, if that's what you're asking.
Do you know what it was he was working on?
They won't tell me. Or'd they tell you?
They said he was carrying a full caseload, including a missing person's—
The stripper, that whore. Doesn't it figure that that's the case they would focus on?
The old sheriff adjusted himself on the sofa in order to sit forward. Were there other things you know about?
Things that would make a lot of very important people in this town more than a little nervous, yes.
Lucian sighed. Things like what?
I'm not sure I want to tell you about them if you're not going to help me.
Another longer pause.
He was a good man, Lucian. He helped you and nobody else would. And now he's dead. I think you owe him something more than a phone call.
I could feel him nodding. Not as young as I used to be, Phyllis.
I'm assuming that's why you brought him.
Even with my hat over my face, I could feel their eyes shift to me. It is.
He as good as they say?
I waited and listened. When I hired him, I told him two things. No man has any sense till age 35, and damn few afterwards.
Amen to that. And the other?
Never go after a man to arrest him unless you are certain you are legally right. But then arrest him or die. I felt him shift and was sure he was looking straight at me now. In all the time I've known him, I've never seen him quit. Which is where most of them ain't up to snuff. They give out. If he's got any give in him, ain't nobody found it yet.
He's big.
That he is, but that ain't the half of it. He got up from the sofa, and I could hear him limp over to her. Is that the room over there? The one where you kept Connie? She didn't say anything, so he continued. I want to warn you that if you put water on this, you're going to find out what it's all about, one way or the other.
Another pause,
and I could see the face that was peering down at her, a visage to which I was accustomed. You're sure you want that? Because he's like a gun. Once you point him and pull the trigger, it's too late to change your mind. Oh, jeez, if it isn't dangerous and dangerouser. Sandy Sandberg, the sheriff of Campbell County, pulled out a chair, sat at our table, and propped up a large manila folder on the windowsill beside him, careful to pick a spot where the condensation wouldn't do any damage. It was cold in the little Mexican restaurant in Gillette's industrial section beside the interstate highway. Late on a Sunday night, the patrons were few and far between. As a matter of fact, we were the only ones around. A skinny waitress came from behind the counter and sat a cup of coffee in front of Sandy.
¿Cómo estás?
Hola, guapa. ¿Qué tal?
Cansada. Sandberg reached out and gripped one of her thin arms and slid the sleeve of her sweater up to reveal a speckling of old scabs. "Se mantiene limpia?" She shrugged, pulled her arm away, and yanked a pad and pencil from her apron. "Me bañé en la mañana." His eyes diverted to us as he let the girl go. "As you might expect, the burritos are pretty damn good." He glanced back at the waitress and held up three fingers. "Tres, por favor. Beef or the green stuff." He watched her go and then turned back to the two of us. "Gentlemen, there's no mystery." Lucian cocked his hat back on his head, looking like Will Rogers ready to make a run in a casino. "Phyllis Holman, by God, seems to think otherwise."
"The bereaved widow? Well, she would."
I volunteered. "She doesn't seem to like you." Lucian glanced at me, now sure I had been awake on the sofa.
"Yeah, I get that, too," Sandy shrugged. "Hell, I don't know what I did to her but offer her retired husband a job in the cold case task force."
Maybe that was it. I eased back in my chair as far as I could without fear of breaking it. "How many on the cold case task force, anyway?"
"One."
Sandy grinned with his matinee idle smile, the one that got other people in trouble, his teeth white against the tan he acquired at Coco View Resort in Honduras every Christmas.
"Started it up just so Gerald would have something to do."
The smile faded.
"Then this happens. I gotta tell you, of all the fellas I would have thought would go out this way, Jerry would have been the last."
I sipped my already cold coffee.
"Why?"
Sandy clicked his eyes to mine.
"Ever meet him?"
"No."
"He was so by the book that he might as well have published the damn thing."
He looked at Lucian.
"Am I right or am I right?"
"Gerald Holman never broke a rule by force of bending one, that's for damn sure."
He glanced at the folder next to Sandy's elbow.
"That the report?"
"It is. We've got a DCI field office up here with two cashiers and a bag boy."
The colorful euphemisms the sheriff used were a result of the Division of Criminal Investigations headquarters in Cheyenne being an old grocery store.
"But they drove the deathmobile up here anyway and did a full autopsy."
I sat my mug down with more of a thunk than I'd really wanted. They both looked at me. Sandy reached over and opened the folder and read.
"On December 13th, one Gerald Holman placed the barrel of his issued sidearm, a .357 revolver, in his mouth and pulled the trigger. It was established by agents of the Division of Criminal Investigation that the individual locked in the room from the inside had opportunity and the condition for the decedent to have self-inflicted his injury. Further investigation revealed that no one else had been in the room, verified by eyewitnesses, position of the decedent's body in relation to the unlikely position the assailant would have to have assumed, blood spatter, and the gunpowder residue on the decedent's hand. A gun cleaning kit was found on the bed beside the decedent, but it was determined that the firing of the weapon was not accidental."
"Lest he was licking the damn thing clean."
I ignored Lucian's remark. "Demonstrations of intent?" Sandy continued reading.
"He used a pillow to muffle the noise."
I looked out the window, at the reflection of three men attempting to understand why one of their own had done what he had done.
"Personal effects? Untouched."
"Note?"
"Nope,"
he said at me.
"There's nothing here, Walt."
"Can I have the report?"
He folded it up and started to hand it to me, but then stopped as my fingers touched it.
"Promise to bring it back?"
I didn't move. "Make copies if you want." He shoved it at me.
"I trust you."
I began looking at the photos and reading the summary report from the DCI investigators. "Who is Rankaj Patel?"
"Ah, the Pakistani guy that owns the Wrangler Motel where the incident took place, about a mile east of here."
"Indian." Sandy studied me.
"What?"
"Indian. The man's Indian." I watched him think about it.
"No, he ain't Indian,"
Lucian interrupted.
"Dot, not feather."
"Huh?"
I continued leafing through the folder. The photos were, as usual, gruesome. About a third of all motel owners in the U.S. are called Patel. It's a surname that indicates that they're members of a Gujarati Hindu subcaste. I looked up at his confused face
and figured I might as well educate him on the subject. The Indian caste structure has four principal divisions and a myriad of subcastes, of which Patel is one. Vaishyas, or traders, were at one time employed to calculate the tithes that were owed to medieval kings by farmers in Gujarat, an Indian province on the Arabian Sea. Sandy shook his head and looked at Lucian. "Was he like this when you hired him?"
He nodded. "Better than a bookmobile."
I put the folder behind me, uninterested in looking at it any more, before I ate. "What was he working on?"
"Lots of things, nothing earth-shaking."
"Can I see those files?"
"Richard Harvey says he'd be glad to meet with you tomorrow morning."
I nodded. "That his replacement?" Sandy smiled again, and I knew the real trouble had begun.
"Of sorts."
The Wrangler Motel sat on the eastern side of Gillette like it was run out of town. With a lone strip of 8 ground floor and 9 second floor units, it was anchored to the high plains by a decrepit cafe-slash-bar, the Aces and Eights, on one end and an equally run-down office on the other. I was standing in said office, arguing with Rankaj Patel about a $20 pet fee for dog. He was a tiny man and, as I had suspected, of Indian descent. I looked down at the worn, stained carpet and collapsed chairs, and up at the moth-stained art on the walls.
"You're kidding,"
he responded in a sing-song lilt.
"It is a corporate policy, sir."
"What corporation?"
He spread his hands in a gesture of largesse.
"The Wrangler Motel Corporation, sir."
"Of which you are the chairman of the board and CEO?" I pulled out my wallet and adjusted my thinking to the fact that I was paying half as much for dog as I was for Lucian and me. "I'll also need the key to room 12. He half-turned with the key to room 5, the one he had selected for us, and froze.
"I'm afraid that room is not available, sir."
I pulled my new badge wallet from the back pocket of my jeans.
"There was an accident."
"I know."
The stiffness of the leather caused the thing to fall from my fingers and land on the counter between us like a shot quail, ruining what I had hoped to be a dramatic effect. I reached down and spread it open so that he could see the 6-point star. "I'm the guy who's supposed to find out why there was an accident." He studied the badge, taking in the fact that the county was adjacent.
"I told the investigators everything I know."
"I'm sure you did, but if you think of anything else, I'd appreciate it if you would tell me."
He nodded.
"How long will you be staying?"
I picked up the keys to both rooms.
"As long as it takes."
I ignored the signs, backed in, and parked in front of room 5. Dog jumped out and immediately began sniffing the surroundings as I opened the tailgate and handed Lucian his overnight bag and the key.
"How well did you know Holman?" "Not that well. We worked a few cases together."
"Children?"